There we go. Good morning, everybody. You are at the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And good morning, Bruce. How are you this morning?
I'm good. And yourself?
I'm absolutely wonderful, as always. Is that a kitty?
That's Sophie saying good morning, too, to everyone.
Good morning. So what's going on, Bruce? It's been a couple weeks since we talked, and what's happening with you?
Oh, yes. More of the same. not a whole lot of any consequence is new, I suppose. I'm just enjoying the process of looking at my mind and watching things. My wife and I watched the Groundhog Day movie last night. I hadn't seen that for a number of years, but we used to watch that every year and hadn't kind of gotten out of the habit and watched it again. I was thinking, what a great reminder that it's really the habitual, steady practice of, you know, mindfully looking at the contents of our unconscious and forgiving that. And, you know, over time, as that movie suggests, you know, it may take lifetimes, but we can shorten it up dramatically by just doing the forgiveness exercises that A Course in Miracles suggests and is reflected in the work of Ken Wapnick and Gary Renard and some of our other mentors that are kindred souls that are helping us return home to where we never left, huh?
Exactly. And it's really interesting today's lesson. Lesson 34, I can see peace instead of this, really is a foundation for looking at these thoughts. Yep. and deciding, you know, how do I want to see this? You know, do I want to see this as peace or do I want to see this as attack? Do I want to see this as joy or do I want to see this as anger, upset? You know, I have the choice. I could see peace instead of this. That was a pretty powerful teaching from Jesus.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of two that Ken Wapnick said. If you were, I think paraphrasing, he said something to the effect of, you know, if you only could remember two, like if you're stranded on a desert island or something, workbook lessons, the two to remember would be 5 and 34. I'm never upset for the reason I think, and I could see peace instead of this. And if you, you know, just really, truly practice those, you'd have the course.
Well, yeah.
practice consistently, right? Oh, sorry. I was talking over you. Say again.
That's okay. It's pretty much the entire course.
Yeah, exactly.
So simple. All right, yeah. So we are reading Gary Renard's newest book, and that is the Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, and it's all very interesting. I think we finished chapter one last
time. I believe so. That's where my little bookmark was the beginning of chapter two.
So we are going on to chapter two, From Shintoism to Lao Tzu, Early Peak Experiences. And one thing that Arsene and Pertin do in this, Arsene and Persa do in this this book is kind of rearrange our time frame of things. And I notice that people making comments, a lot of the comments that they're saying are, according to history, this person was at this time and this person came before then. And Arten and Persa are saying, no, you know, that's not really the true timeline. And, of course, you know, that's it's all pretty much a timeline that is, it's all part of the script. So there really is, all time is happening in this very instant. Everything is happening at this very moment. So, you know, there isn't a past or isn't a future of anything. So these timelines that we talk about really are pretty well arbitrary. And since no one is alive today that was then, you know, here then, you know, we really don't have proof of anything. And in fact, you know, if you looked at it, and this has been made commented many times, is that the Romans, although they were meticulous as far as record keeping, there is no recording of a census during the time when Jesus supposedly was born, where people had to go to some place to be counted. That was not part of their practices. This is kind of a story that someone made up, because there's no evidence or there's no record. And again, the Romans were very meticulous record keepers, so there would be a record of that particular happening. There would be a record of many of the happenings, including like the crucifixion, if that was such a big deal, that there was a trial in front of Pilate and all of those things. Those were, you know, that would have been kept record. And there's no record of that in the Roman records. What we think of history, when you start going actually through the books, you find out really that's not the history, but it's the assumed history based on our, based on our assumed timeline that we think is real or true. Just be prepared to have your mind blown about what history really is, because this book is going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And as you were saying that, when you said the phrase true timeline, I was thinking, well, in terms of pure non-duality, which is what A Course in Miracles is all about, that phrase true timeline is quite an oxymoron, because time and space themselves are fictitious ideas that were made up that have nothing to do with truth, with a capital T, that, you know, A Course in Miracles would suggest, because they are all things that change. And change, of course, is so almost by definition, depending how I like to define, so if truth is something that doesn't change, then anything that does change, which would include space and time, can't possibly be part of that. And I think that's where we sometimes get into trouble, is trying to, you know, again, confuse the levels and think that, well, if something happened in this, you know, dream of a world that we call reality, then, you know, that has some bearing on our real identity. And this study suggests that, well, maybe what we really are is outside of space and time. In fact, dwarfs the whole space-time cosmos universe, and, you know, makes it essentially zero. And what we really are is infinite, but it's an infinite unity, which is, again, something we can't wrap our heads around. But we do have techniques to approach that and to remove the barriers that are keeping us from that awareness. And that's, I think, where the brilliance of the curriculum that we call A Course in Miracles comes in, because it helps us to see that there really isn't anything other than a decision in the mind that we've made that is keeping us from that awareness. And by practicing the shared interest that the Course suggests, and trusting our inner kindness teacher, and forgiving the things that come up from our unconscious mind as a result of that curriculum, we gradually undo all the barriers. And at some point, as the Course says, you know, God takes the final step and you know, metaphorically, and we go beyond all the oxymorons of our dream. So anyway, thank you for using that phrase, because it was kind of like interesting triggers. Like, well, you know, how interesting to kind of notice, you know, in a lucid, mindful way, all the different things that cross our path in a given day. And, you know, just kind of like practicing the workbook lessons, if we can just kind of notice the things that come up and say, oh, yeah, there's a little bit of propaganda from the ego mind to reinforce the idea that we're going to find some kind of happiness here in the dream, whereas it's really only going to be found in a decision in the mind, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, that's why today's lesson, I could see peace instead of this, really, you know, he says, the idea for today begins to describe the conditions that prevail in the other way of seeing. Peace of mind is clearly an internal matter. It must begin with your own thoughts and then extend outward. It is from your peace of mind that a peaceful perception of the world arises. So that's a huge thing, right? It's from a peaceful mind that this perception of a world of peace. And, you know, what's the problem in the world, you know, if I look at it and don't see a problem? You know, if I look at the world and I just see peace, then where is the problem? You know, unless I'm in denial and I'm saying, well, you know, that war is not really happening, or that, you know, that child really wasn't murdered. You know, that's denial. But if I could see the truth about it and see that It is true that nobody has ever been murdered and nothing ever really happened. But in order for me to be aware of that and to have that the certainty of the truth of that, I really have to let go of my previous perception of what I thought it was. And I have to let go of my my conviction that there is such a thing as a good action and a bad action, that there is something helpful and there is something hurtful. You know, I have to give up those thoughts of judgment that say one thing is better than another. There is an order of difficulty in miracles. Some things are easier to fix than others. The war is a hard thing to fix, but, you know, how I feel about my next door neighbor is an easier thing. It's not true. It's all the same thing. And there is no order of difficulty in miracles. And Jesus says that several times, talks about, you know, the reason you think this is because you think there is an order. You think that some things are better than others. And so looking at our thoughts, and then as those thoughts arise, looking at the source of those thoughts and letting go of my misconception about what is, really brings about a shift and a change in the way that I see things. And if I look at that war and I don't see a problem, for reals, for sure, then I can see peace.
Yeah.
But, exactly. You know, as long as I hold on to those thoughts, they will be there.
Yeah. As you were saying that, Lynn, I was thinking, you know, the beauty, I think, of the metaphor, the metaphors, because there's plenty of them in A Course in Miracles. The one in particular that I find really helpful is in addition to dreaming, the acting, that we're like on a stage, and this is like a giant holographic stage. And on a level form, sure, people are getting murdered and that sort of thing, but that isn't our real identity. Like you say, you know, we don't want to deny our physical data, but we just want to deny the ego's interpretation of it, which would basically suggest that we're at the mercy of this dream of a world wherein, in fact, in truth, we can afford to be merciful by seeing that it's a dream. And that takes a lot of practice and a lot of repetition. And that's why I think these, you know, it's not like we can shortcut the process, but we can certainly use mnemonics and rules of thumb and very helpful reminders, such as those two workbook lessons. And this morning I was sending to another friend that I just had a conversation with on his radio show earlier this week a couple of quotes from the supplements that are my favorites, and they're both about forgetting, which is really about undoing the ego's remembering. The one is from the Song of Prayer, which is, the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need. And the other from the psychotherapy pamphlet is healing. I'm going to paraphrase this one. Healing begins the instant the psychotherapist, which is really all of us, forgets to judge the patient, which is, you know, anytime we forget to judge each other, we're we're remembering that the true evaluation of a real self that we all share is beyond measure, and it's just silly to condemn ourselves and each other to anything less than all of spirit. So should we start reading chapter 2 in Gary's fourth book? Are you still there, Lynn? Hello, Lynn?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Did you have your microphone muted?
Yeah, mute the microphone, yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, so I'll read if you want. I'll read
sure.
The little quote at the beginning in the first paragraph.
Uh-huh.
So, the beginning of chapter 2, it says, from a quote from the Tao Te Ching, desire and discontent lead to misfortune. Seeking worldly things is folly. Those who are rich are those who are contented with what they have. And that is from the Tao Te Ching. And,
that fits in quite nicely with the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need, huh?
Exactly. Absolutely. See, what a coincidence.
mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So this is Gary. I wasn't a student of the ancient traditions or comparative religion. I really didn't care much about those things, and I had no intention of changing that. Still, I figured if Artin and Persa were going to talk about different lifetimes when Jay and Buddha knew each other, then maybe I should do some homework, but I didn't. It usually surprises people to learn that I don't read much. There may be 20 books I've read in my life that have made a real difference to me. The truth is, I'd still rather go see a movie than read a book any day. So, kind of interesting that, you know, Gary didn't know anything about Jesus and Buddha, and that he really wasn't wanting to find out either at this time. Anyway, do you have any thoughts on that or comments, or want to go on to the next paragraph?
I was just going to say that, we get what we need, and sometimes the emissaries that appear to be other people and other events and circumstances in our life that bring to us the contents of our unconscious mind. That is really something that I was also sharing in another email this morning to a new friend. I love Ken Wapnick's reminder that, you know, Freud was on the right track when he said, you know, the dreams are the royal road to the unconscious mind, basically, and that reminding us that, of course, Miracles says in numerous places that, you know, all of our time is spent in dreaming. And if that's the case, if we're dreaming of space and time and the belief in separation and this entire huge holographic projected universe, then that becomes an opportunity to see that if we're dreaming, we can afford to forgive, because there's nothing, you know, as the Beatles say, nothing to get hung about. And so, you know, why would we want to be upset by, you know, a puppet show or a dream or a play or an enactment in a hologram that has no truth to it, that doesn't have any bearing on an eternal reality that we all share. So anyway, I thought it'd also be good to mention the chapter titles. I don't know if we said that, the second chapter in Gary's book, which is The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. This is Gary Renard's fourth book. The chapter, second chapter title is From Shintoism to Lao Tzu, Early Peak Experiences. So he's, and put it in context, in the first chapter, he kind of gave the groundwork for this conversation with Artin and Persa about half a dozen lifetimes that Jesus and Buddha shared. And now he's going into the first of those six lifetimes. So I'll continue on with the next paragraph. However, the first time I ever became interested in spirituality was when I was 21 years old. That was a good 7 years before I began what I would call being on a spiritual path. A friend of mine lent me a book and said, "You've got to read this." It was Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha. It blew me away. That was the book that piqued my interest in things of a spiritual nature. Before that, I hated life, hated people, and hated God. After that, I still did. I was depressed and had lost interest in life, if I ever had much interest in life to begin with. It wouldn't be until I was older that my transformation would begin, leading all the way to a place where today I can honestly say that I love God. When I read Siddhartha, I didn't understand all the religious jargon of Hinduism, but I understood the story. I could relate to the young man who wanted to be free and to the fact that he was rich and found it meaningless and took off to find salvation instead. To show you how green I was in the spirituality, I read the entire book and still didn't know it was about Buddha. I would find that out later. Well, I have a confession to make. I did the same thing a few decades ago when I ran across Siddhartha. So anyway, so we're in the same boat, Gary.
and you know what's really interesting about this? Siddhartha is one of the very first books I read, too, when I was 15. Mm-hmm. I read, I got two books out of the library. One was The Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda, and the other was Siddhartha. And I read The Autobiography of a Yogi twice. I've said this before. I read it I got to the last page and I turned and started again from the beginning. That's a big book. Siddhartha I read and I thought it was beautiful and I really enjoyed it. I didn't even think about it, but, then not a couple years ago, I reread Siddhartha. And, although it's called Siddhartha and it's about a young man's, journey from being a wealthy person to and a prince basically to becoming awakened. It is not really the story of the Buddha. Siddhartha was a different character in this book. And he actually meets up with the Buddha. They go, he and his friend, Govinda, travel around as ascetics, as they are studying and practicing poverty, etc. And they do come upon the Buddha. They come to the Buddha who is teaching in a grove, and they spend time with him. And Siddhartha decides to go on, and Govinda decides to stay. So Govinda stays with the Buddha, and Siddhartha moves on. But there's a very interesting exchange that happens in the book when Siddhartha is walking away from the camp, and he comes upon the Buddha, and the Buddha is there in the woods, and he has a conversation with him. And the Buddha says, well, your friend is staying, why are you leaving? And Siddhartha says, because you cannot give me what you have. You can teach, and everyone can listen, and we can all learn, but you cannot give me what you have. Which, you know, meaning, you know, the Buddha could not awaken him or enlighten him. The teachings of the Buddha could not awaken him or enlighten him. The only thing that could awaken him or enlighten him was his own experience. And so he leaves the Buddha and goes on and has other adventures and goes into wealth and poverty and all sorts of things before he finally ends up there by the river as the boatman and actually becoming an awakened or enlightened. So the story of Siddhartha is not necessarily about the Buddha, although he does encounter the Buddha in the story, but he does become awakened or enlightened at the end. So just for that. So
okay, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, it's been decades since I read it, so I'd forgotten a good part of it. So,
well, it's real interesting because that particular exchange between him and the Buddha, when I read that a few years ago, it just shifted something in me. That I recognize that these teachers that we love and we follow and we listen to, and, you know, I listen to different satsangs from different teachers. You know, I listen to Rupert Spira and Roger Castillo and all these different people, Muji. And, you know, what I recognize is saying, well, Ken Wapnick. Look how many people went to see Ken Wapnick again and again and again and again over the years, and they could never actually achieve what Ken had achieved because they were listening, but they were not, I don't know why, you know, I don't know why they didn't awaken from being in his presence, but you can tell, you listen to the recordings and you hear the same people asking the same questions week after week after week, and it's very clear that being in the presence of an awakened person doesn't necessarily make you become awakened. You have to do the work yourself. And that's what Siddhartha is all about. He left and went to, and did the work himself, and he became awakened. So so I'll go on to the next paragraph after all that. All right. So when I read Siddhartha, I didn't understand all the religious jargon of Hinduism, but I understood the story. I could relate to the young man who wanted to be free and to the fact that he was rich but found it meaningless and took off to find salvation instead. To show you how green I was on the subject of spirituality, I read the entire book and still didn't know it was about Buddha. I would find that out later. At the time, I didn't think about the Holy Spirit. Yet looking back at my crazy 20s, I can see that the Holy Spirit was always working with me, saving my life. Me too. Absolutely. The Holy Spirit works with everybody all the time, whether they are aware of it or not. I can see now that when I was 27, the Holy Spirit was nudging me in the right direction, persuading me to listen to my friend Dan's advice and do the Earhart Seminar Training, EST, EST. Without going into the story, EST was exactly what I needed at the time. It doesn't exist anymore, but of the million people who did it, it wouldn't surprise me if at least 100,000 of them went on to do A Course in Miracles. It was a great precursor. And yes, I know many people who did, including David Fishman, who did EST and then found A Course in Miracles after that. So yes, I think it is a great bridge. or, you know, everything, whatever.
Anything that, that helps us, you know, look in an introspective way at the contents of our mind certainly is moving in the right direction, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. And did you do AST? I knew a lot of people who did.
You know, I did. I have friends that have done it, but I never did that myself. I did explore a lot of other different metaphysical buffet line kind of stuff over several decades before coming back to the course in 2007. But, you know, I became aware of A Course in Miracles in the 70s when it first, you know, not long after it first came out. Since, you know, it was being promoted by, you know, the likes of Jerry Jampolsky and Marianne Williamson, but it wasn't really until the mid-80s that I actually took up the study in earnest. So, yeah.
I almost did ask, but then they told me that you couldn't leave the room and you couldn't use the bathroom and you couldn't. They started to tell me all these things you couldn't do, and I just, not for me.
Yeah. I appreciated that people had gotten a lot out of it, so.
Exactly.
Yep. So I'll read the next paragraph. We all have a right mind where the Holy Spirit dwells and a wrong mind which is dominated by the ego and its thoughts of separation. Which part of the mind controls us is decided by the third part of the mind, the part that observes and chooses. That's where our real power, the power of decision, is. You make that decision mostly in how you choose to think of others. And this is what Ken Wapnick refers to as the decision maker. And then all the wonderful diagrams he put together over the years, he calls it he has a little blue dot on his chart that I got to watch the last of the streaming workshops from Temecula a week ago, Wednesday, by Jeff and Rosemary, and that may resurface again. Apparently they're moving their headquarters, FACIM, to Henderson, Nevada later this year. So, and I got a little sneak preview of the new website, which is wonderful, and collaborated with the folks who are building that website. And so anyway, but it's kind of fun to see where all this is going and all the different things that continue to inspire us and resurface in different ways, huh?
Yeah, and I'm guessing it's because Gloria wanted to move to Nevada, is what the scuttlebutt I heard, and I think that's probably, you know, good for her.
Well, her son David, who has been putting together the website, it lives there, so that's, I think, a big part of it. But that's just an assumption on my part. So,
I agree that, but you know, I think it's good. God bless Gloria Wapnick.
She had a nice cameo in the day-long workshop at the beginning and expressed with, you know, very sincere and profound gratitude all the support that people had given to the foundation over the years and was very reassuring, saying, you know, the foundation is not going away. This is, you know, one of the two sister foundations of A Course in Miracles, the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which is, you know, still currently in Southern California, and the Foundation for Inner Peace, of course, being the other half of the two organizations being in Northern California primarily. Anyway, Gloria was basically very heartfelt expression of gratitude and appreciation, and also to reassure people that, you know, that foundation is not going away. It's just, you know, morphing into a different geography for the most part, and it'll be a, you know, transitional period, but it'll be fun to see how it resurfaces and reemerges, and so, yeah. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. Let's see. Did you end up with decision mostly in how you choose to think of others? Was that the last?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
The decision maker, which kind of reminded me of Ken, of course.
Exactly. Then the blue dot, and that's where
we came. Yeah, exactly. The joke on that is in one of Ken's talks, you know, after countless workshops where he talks about, you know, the blue dot is sort of the representation in his chart for the decision making power of the mind. Somebody asked, well, where is the blue dot? And he says, oh, well, we keep the original in a vault in case we ever need to sell it, you know, something like that. I thought that was pretty funny.
That is hilarious. God, you know, people don't even recognize, you know, someone was writing the other day, well, you know, it's pretty obvious. I didn't know about Ken. I never heard about him. I never listened to him, but you know, it's pretty obvious that he, you know, basically only had an intellectual understanding of this course. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
you know where I think it comes across? I mean, because his videos are very, I wouldn't say necessarily scholarly, but they're, they're done in, you know, a less whimsical tone, but where I think where the humor and the heart comes across super loud and clear is the audio recordings. And if anybody hasn't heard, you know, some of his audio recordings, especially when he's interacting with the people who are attending his presentations, the joyous, playful sense of humor that he has comes across so loud and clear. And I never in person, quote unquote, got to meet Ken, but I feel like I was expressing with another mutual friend and course teacher, Susan Dugan, the other day. You know, I feel like I know him better than I know members of my own family in a lot of ways, because the quality of his, not only his insight and profound depth and breadth of inspiration and prolific writing and all the work that he did, but the feeling of acceptance and loving kindness that he shares is just profound, and his sense of humor is just abundantly obvious. If you listen to you know, a handful of his audios, you'll get that very clearly.
He is very funny, very funny.
Oh,
and very playful and very loving, and you know, everybody who was around him, if you saw him, you know, he liked to tease people and, you know, flip their ponytails and play with their hats and, you know, whatever. You know, he always had some gig going on with people. And everybody who was around him, I think, felt so personally loved, so personally cherished, that, you know, you can see, you know, why people have the kind of reaction to Ken that they have. So, like I said, if you didn't know him, if in listening to his audio recordings, yeah, it's apparent he is so filled with joy and light and such a whimsical sense of humor. God, you know, gotta love Ken Wapnick. So,
oh, absolutely. A quick aside, one more story that comes to mind, in addition to you know, other folks like Gary saying that Ken would always mess up his hair and just in a playful way, and another friend, Marissa, who said, you know, that he would come up behind people and, you know, put his hands over their eyes and, you know, do guess who, you know, just silly, playful, fun stuff. The story that sticks in my mind is dear friend Jonathan Joshua, who I am part of a study group on Wednesday evenings online, and aloha, shout out to Jonathan. Anyway, he said that when he was down there in Temecula, the one time he was there, shortly before Ken passed, the first time he actually met Ken was in the men's restroom. And Ken says, "Who are you?" And Jonathan, without thinking, apparently said something like, "Oh, nobody." And then they both laughed, and Ken said, "Oh, well, I'm nobody too." But I just thought that was such a great, you know, telltale encounter, you know, just a little, you know, vignette of the quality of humor and not taking the dream seriously that obviously Ken got profoundly and was able to share not only eloquently but with so much heart over the years. And anyway, so much gratitude. Yeah,
and that also is, you know, if you really, really want to know what Jesus is talking about, and you don't have any fear, you don't have any upset, you love everything around you, everything you see brings you joy, you know, this is the kind of, you know, Jesus asks us in the lessons, you know, when you get to that point, or he tells us, when you get to the point where, you know, everything you see is just perfect, and you are happy no matter what, you know, then you pretty well made it. And I could see that in Ken. Mm-hmm. You know, he was not upset by things. He was not afraid of things. He was just a symbol of pure love and light. And it was so evident, exuded from him as a person. I don't know if anyone could ever have actually met him without loving him. Yeah. Although I know a lot of people who try. But, you know, that's Ken. All right. So, let's see. Did I even read this yet? No. You can always tell which students are understanding and applying the course and which ones are not. Okay, that brings about an idea about judgment, right? I can tell you're doing it and I can tell you're not. Not my business. All right, but anyway, you can tell. The ones who are understanding have no need to judge and condemn others. If they do, they catch themselves and stop themselves and change their minds. On the other hand, the students who are resisting the message and practice of the Course are very, very good at pointing out the ego in somebody else. They're experts at it. Oh, he's in his ego is a favorite observation. But that's not forgiveness. A Course in Miracles is not about spotting the ego in somebody else. It's about recognizing that there is nobody else. Not really. And all the things you don't like about others are actually what the Course calls the secret sins and hidden hates that you really have about yourself that you have chosen to see in other people through the dynamic of projection. Thus, when you forgive the other person who appears to be there, you are really forgiving yourself. I wondered if Jay and Buddha were open to such ideas in the early years of their spiritual experience. So that's a very profound paragraph there.
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing. Exactly. That's the whole course in a sense, or a huge part of it right there in that one paragraph, isn't it?
Exactly. And yeah, you know, when I can see your ego instead of you, that only means I'm the one who's looking through my ego. It's the ego that sees the ego.
And I like
spirit.
Oh, I was just going to say, I like Dove's, David Fishman's comment about, if you spot it, you got it. Which is basically saying, you know, regardless of what thought system you're in, you're going to see through the lens of that thought system. So if I'm, you know, operating from ego, then everything I see is going to be a part of that nightmarish dream. Whereas if I'm listening to my inner kindness teacher, aka Holy Spirit, or the Jesus of A Course in Miracles, if you will, then everything is going to, I'm going to drop ego's misinterpretation and just see through and beyond the form to the beauty that's there. And I was reminded of that with a, you know, the quote early in the text, you know, I've saved all of your loving thoughts and the beauty and kept them in their perfect radiance or something like that, you know. And, you know, and purified them of their errors. I forget exactly how it goes, but it's, you know, it's basically, you know, the truth is that what we really are is profoundly, innocent, perfect, and love. And if we see anything less than that, that means we're still misinterpreting. And because we're taking the dream at face value and believing that to be reality, and that's what A Course in Miracles is, you know, the study that we refers to as level confusion. So that's,
exactly.
And that's something we just need to work through until we don't confuse the levels anymore, because we have an enormous resistance again, and that's because we're so invested in the ego, and we have to be patient and gentle with ourselves as we go through this process. So
absolutely. And Jack has posted on the board, I have saved all your kindnesses and every loving thought you ever had. And it's
that's
true.
The one.
That's it. And it is not because, you know, there's some kind of special thing, but it's the only thing. You know, when Jesus says in that first miracle principle, you know, all expressions of love are maximal, he's saying that, you know, any expression of love is it. You know, any expression of love is it no matter what. So it may seem flawed to me. I may look at it and say, well, it's not really very loving because, you know, I was having this motive, or I thought this, or this was really in the back of my mind. But any expression of love, any expression in which I reach out of my own self and extend to another, no matter, you know, how flawed it may seem to me, is still maximal according to Jesus. That's an amazing thing. And Jack also posts, all your past except its beauty is gone, and nothing is left but a blessing. And
That's it. Those are the two that I was thinking of, yeah, which I was sort of conflating together.
Well,
thank you, Jack.
Yay, team. Good job. Yeah. All right. You want to read on?
Sure. I wouldn't have to wait long to find out. This is talking about his interest in if Jay and Buddha were open to such ideas in the early years of their spiritual experience. I was walking home from doing errands on a typically mild and sunny January day in California. I got home, closed the door, turned around, and was astonished to see my teachers already sitting on my couch. Startled, I said, "Don't do that." They just looked at me with their gentle smiles. Then it goes on, Persa, Don't you ever get tired of this perfect weather? Gary, no, except if we don't get some rain here soon, then we're all screwed and tattooed. You know, I've been hearing there's a drought here for the last 2 years. Note, this conversation took place in January 2014, which is a little bit over 4 years ago. As at the time that Lynn and I are reading this, that is. But I've been here for 6 years, and as far as I can see, there's been a drought the whole time, except for maybe two wet weeks. I assume that's global warming? PERSA, that's part of it. But don't forget there have always been droughts all through history, all over the world. Sometimes they're so bad they cause civilization to end because the people have to go where the food and water is. That's what happened to the Mayans, and that's what happened to Cahokia, I think that's. I forget how you say it. Anyway, Gary, so we take nature for granted until it turns around and bites us on the gonads. But there is global warming, right? PERSA, yes, and your drought situation is here for a long time. That's a big problem that can't be solved in a year or two, but that's not what we came to talk about. Artin, this visit we're going to tell you about a couple of the lifetimes where our two masters met, knew, and helped each other. We'll tell you about a few more of these common lifetimes later. Sometimes they helped each other with knowledge and observation. Sometimes they helped by giving the other a forgiveness opportunity. Gary, yeah, I love forgiveness opportunities. I like the little drops of blood they form on my forehead. I read this for a few months ago, and I forgot how much humor was in this. Artin, people who are in each other's orbit will meet repeatedly. In the overall scheme of the illusion, you may appear to be in a body every 100 years or so. Sometimes more often if you have a dream where you don't live long, then obviously you have more time to dream another lifetime in that interval. You can think of what we would call the modern era of history to be the last 5,000 years. That's just this cycle of history, and you know very little about what happened before that. Not that you know that much about what happened in the last 5,000 years either. In any case, the first time period and place we'd like to mention is about 700 BC in Japan, for reasons we'll get into. Now, the truth is there is no physical evidence, absolutely no proof, that Jay, Buddha, or Lao Tzu ever existed. Some people actually believe they're made-up characters or perhaps composite characters. That's not true. They did exist in the dream and were just as real as anybody else appears to be. There's that level of confusion again. And the oxymorons I was alluding to earlier. Historians will dispute exactly when they lived, which is kind of funny since they can't prove that they lived, but will tell you when they did. Although it wasn't the first time they came across each other, for the purposes of our discussion, the first important relationship between the beings we call Jay and Buddha took place at the time period we mentioned, around 700 BC. Shintoism is one of the oldest religions in the world, although it's more of a tradition than a religion. Shintoism is particularly dominant in Japan. Even today, about 80% of the people there think of themselves as being Shinto. Like any country and any religion, though, some people are more serious about it than others. Do you want to go on?
Sure. So Gary says, so Jay and Buddha were Shintos? And PERSA says, yes, at that time, Jay's name was Sakka, and Buddha's name was Hiroji, although we're simplifying those names. And keep in mind that what's regarded as a sort of Bible of the Shinto religion, the Kojiki, wasn't formalized until much later in the time period we're talking about. This was more like the 8th century A.D., even before 700 B.C., you had a long time where Shintoism was an oral tradition, being handed down through the generations. 2,700 years ago, Sakka and Hiroji were friends who were faithful in the religion as well as to the emperor. In fact, it wouldn't have been a good idea not to be loyal to the emperor since he owned you. And I think at that time, the emperor was considered a god. That's my intake on there, that the emperor at the time was considered a god. Mm-hmm. Okay, so back to the reading. He owned everybody. For all intents and purposes, the emperor was God. Yeah, there you go. That belief on the part of the people lasted right up until after World War II. Oh, Gary says, that would explain the size of the emperor's palace. As I'm sure you know, I was there in Japan to speak about 6 years ago, and it took a 20-minute car ride just to go around the palace. PERSA, you saw a lot of Shinto shrines, too. Gary, Yes, yeah, as well as Buddhist ones. No offense to Buddha, but I like the Shinto's orange-type color better than the reddish-brown Buddhist temples. Not that they aren't impressive, too, but one of the Shinto ones was painted gold. That was beautiful, but I digress. What about these Saka and Orochi guys? Artin, one of the reasons we bring up those lifetimes is to make you aware that even Saka and Orochi came from a place of dualism at times. Even if you don't totally believe in the dream like them, you still go back and forth a lot. Sometimes it's real and sometimes it isn't. Then it is again. And yeah, Gary says this and it's true. Sounds familiar. Artin, Shintoism was and is big on ritual, and that is what you do in the world is very important. You are not going to tell anyone at that time and place that what they did wasn't important. That would be insanity to them, but it's only insanity if it's real. Ursa, the Kajiki is full of songs and poems that, put together with rituals and stories of ancestors, connect the people to an ancient past. When it comes to Shintoism, respecting your ancestors is about as holy a place as you can get. And I know this is maybe he's going to say the same thing later on, but people think that it's ancestor worship, but actually it is acknowledging the connection, the connection of all things and our ancestors being the progenitors of our lives. If we disconnect from them, we don't recognize and don't get really what our place in history and what our place as humans are in the world. And it's interesting that right now in America and maybe all over the world, I don't know, people are getting interested in their ancestry, and maybe in America because of our lack of connection to our ancestors, because we are an immigrant nation, and a lot of immigrants purposely cut out their relationship to their ancestors because they wanted to be American and they wanted their children to be American. They came here. They didn't speak their native languages anymore. They insisted that their children learn to speak English. And now I have a lot of friends who are, you know, Mexican American, from other countries, American, Asian American, Vietnamese, who don't speak the language of their family and don't know the history of their family because of that intentional disconnection, so that they can be American, quote unquote American. And, so now people are going back and trying to find out who are my ancestors. Where did I come from? And I'm doing it. I put in a 23andMe DNA kit, and I'm waiting to find out what my DNA is because, I've been very surprised. My daughter did one, and we're very surprised about the results. So either she was switched at birth, or which is not true, didn't happen, or we have an ancestral origin that we didn't even know existed. And so, the Shintoism was really kind of about remaining connected to our ancestors. And that's just a little aside that I have on that. But I'm going to go on and continue reading. Okay, so Gary says, I've seen moonlight ceremonies on TV of Japanese people in Hawaii lighting these beautiful little paper boat-like objects and having them float out to sea to honor their ancestors. It was really nice. Artin, and it was very important to them. Gary, what you said about the oral tradition, the stories of origin and the rituals and all, it reminds me of the Polynesian oral tradition. I've seen a lot of it in Hawaii. Their history is in their hearts, not in books. And Persa says, very good, as is the connection to nature. Shintoism wouldn't necessarily think of it as oneness, but the sense of connection is there. There are parallels to the Hawaiian gods of nature and to the legends of the origins of the islands. You could extend the similarities to shamanism as well. Although most Japanese people at the time didn't think in terms of oneness, our friends Saka and Hiroji were actually experiencing it at times. Although their mystical experiences were temporary, as with most mystics, they definitely had peak experiences that didn't have much to do with the framework of their religion. In fact, Sokka had an experience of oneness with nature that was very similar to the one you had with the rainforest. And so I'm going to stop reading and let you read the story of Gary and Cindy in the rainforest. And yeah, we're doing the same thing right now. You know, people are earthing, you know, going out barefoot and, you know, walking around to feel the connection to the earth. You know, I can see that in modern times that's been very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can personally attest to having had some wonderful, you know, mystical experiences in the Sierra Nevada as a teenager and in my, you know, 20s and 30s and you know, backpacking past, you know, a week or so out away from the trailheads and above timberline and just, you know, just kind of those kind of experiences where, you know, you're not around the usual cultural reinforcements. And, you know, it's not that you need those things, but sometimes those can be a trigger for a decision in the mind that you've already made to, you know, undo some of the resistance and have some of those experiences. But any experiences that can come and go, as of course miracles would tell us, is not what we're aiming for. We want to have the ultimate, goal really is to have an experience of the oneness which comes through forgiving ourselves for our belief that it isn't. So sort of a roundabout way of saying it, isn't it?
So, all right. So, and did you have to leave?
Yeah, I'm just going to read this next paragraph, and then I'm going to call it good. It says, note, Cindy and I were leading a retreat on the Big Island of Hawaii in June of the year before. It was at Kalani Resort in the rainforest on the Hilo side near the ocean. The place we slept in was screened in, but very open, like sleeping in the forest. Around midnight, I had a sense that the rainforest and the island were speaking to me. The sound of tree frogs, boop, beep, boop, beep, the waves of the nearby ocean, the rustling of the trees, and the sound of the trade winds, as well as a sound that seemed to connect it all, but that I couldn't identify, all came together to make me feel that I was becoming one with all of those things, and thus disappearing into them. There was a language there. The rainforest was communicating with me. I could almost understand what it was saying. I was so close. I wanted to understand it, just like I wanted to understand the Pleiadians. Even though I couldn't quite pick it up, it was there. When I heard it together as one, instead of individual parts, it was there. Then I stopped trying to understand, and I merely understood. I never felt closer to the living organisms of the earth, yet it was beyond the earth. So anyway, I'm going to stop there, and we'll join you next week. Thanks, Lynn, and all, as always, and look forward to picking up next week.
All right, very good. Thank you, Bruce. And hopefully when you hang up, it will not change my connection.
Okay.
I think that's, so yeah, just go ahead and hang up and let's see.
All righty. Bye for now. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Bruce. I love you, brother. See you next week.
Likewise.
All right. So I think I'm still connected. All right. So I'm going to continue on with the next paragraph, which Artin says, in a while, we'll talk about a couple of the early peak experiences Jay and Buddha had at the time of Lao Tzu. But one important distinction to make before that is that unlike the ideas of Shintoism with Taoism, the Tao is formless. So when the Taoists Sokka and Hiroji, whose names we'll give you later, had mystical experiences, they thought of the dream that they returned to differently than they did when they were Shintos. It's a different level of awareness. By the way, when it comes to awareness, there is something you should remember about all people, whether you are fond of it or not. Everyone is doing the best they can with the level of awareness that they have. That is huge to me. I mean, that's one of the most important things that you can remember or know about anybody, is everyone is doing the best they can with the level of awareness that they have. And you can give that to anybody. To have give all to all, you know what? You can give that to everybody. You can give that to them, that, you know, no matter what you think you're doing, no matter how you think of me, no matter anything, you are doing the best you can with the level of awareness that you have. And switch that awareness, and perhaps you may be able to do something different or better than what you had been doing before. So let's see. Gary, quick question before we continue. You never seem to mention Muhammad, and I think you've mentioned Zoroaster only once, back toward the beginning of the visits. Did Jay and Buddha ever come in contact with them? Artin, no. There's a good reason they didn't come into contact with Muhammad. He was 600 years after their final lifetime. Of course, that puts him 600 years after Thomas and Thaddeus, too. That is not what we have. It's not that we have anything against Muhammad. It's just that we weren't personally connected on the level of form. Although, as we said, ultimately all of us are connected. As for Zoroaster, he was 1,000 years before the Japan time period we're talking about. And Jay and Buddha didn't know each other then. By the way, did we say you were once a Sufi Muslim? Gary, yes, but that was after Muhammad. As for Zoroaster, wasn't he in Iran? Artin, yes, but it wasn't called Iran at the time. It used to be called Persia. Persa, getting back to the subject at hand, it turns out that Sokka and Orochi were both interested in the same woman. Her name was Megumi. And isn't that always the case? There's some woman involved. I do want to say that one of the tenets of the Baha'i faith, speaking of Muhammad, Zoroaster, Buddha, Jesus, these are all, and this is amazing to find out, these all came from one of the three wives of Abraham. Abraham had three wives. He had, of course, Sarah and Hagar, who we know about, but he had another wife also who was taken from the folks that from the area of Persia, and her progeny, her children, included Zoroaster, I believe Buddha. These all came from a wife of Abraham. These are all part of the Abrahamic family tradition. So if you ever want to look into that, that's something I learned when I was a Baha'i. And we even had a song called From the Three Wives of Abraham. From the three wives of Abraham, the prophets came to teach us God's most glorious name. Zoroaster and Krishna, those two got the word. And through them the voice of God was heard. I can't remember all the songs, but I'll remember the song. Anyway, all of them, Zoroaster, Krishna, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, all of the prophets, the ones who claim to be, have direct, revelation from God came from the wives of Abraham. So interesting, thought, and you can look it up and you can find out that that's the truth, or somewhat of the truth. Anyway, right now my time is up, and I believe that it is time for Iris, who I don't see in the room yet, but who I'm sure will be here. And I think I'm going to go ahead and play that On Love song again, just because I can. And then I'm going to hang up this Skype.
Beckons to you, follow him, though his ways are hard and steep. And when his wings enfold you, yield to him. Caress your tenderest breath.
He threshes and sifts you, he grinds and he kneads you. And then he assigns you to his sacred fire, that you may become sacred bread for God's sacred feast. All these things shall I do unto you, that you may know the secrets of your heart, and in that knowledge become a
in your fear you seek only love's peace and love's pleasure. Better cover your nakedness and pass out of love's threshing floor. Into a seasonless world where you shall laugh, but not all your laughter. Takes not the from itself. Love possesses not, nor it be possessed. For love is enough.
You should say,
I am in the heart of God. You cannot direct the course of love. Wake at dawn.